Welcome back to 77 Degrees South. After the events at Cape Adare, the inspiring explorers continued south, heading deeper into the Ross Sea region. In this episode, we'll learn about life on the ship, isolated from the rest of the world. We'll hear about icebergs and wildlife, and the inspiring explorers will visit their second hut at Cape Evans on Ross Island under the watchful eye of Mount Erebus. Here, they'll learn about the struggles of the British explorer Captain Robert Falcon Scott and his Terra Nova expedition to the Antarctic, and his ill-fated race to the South Pole. For the inspiring explorers, life at sea journeying through the nutrient-rich waters of the Southern Ocean is full of discovery, not the least because of the 24-hour daylight. Here's Myra Narwai, fresh from a sighting out on deck.
So I think we should start as well. What has just happened. So we're set up to do this interview, this conversation, and then suddenly we all ran outside because we were told there's a humpback whale up ahead. I don't know where you went, but I ran up to the top deck in my gloves. Like, I'm carrying all my layers with me at the moment for any chance that we might need to run out. I've still got my sunglasses and my buff on my head. I will freeze if not. It is actually so cold. And saw this whale diving in and out of the water. It didn't fluke which is when its tail comes up out of the water, but it did. We saw it breach and do the big blow, and we could see it through the very clear water. We could see the white underbelly, and they're just magnificent animals right next to us on the boat. I can't believe that happened.
Yeah, it was really incredible. So I ran up to the sixth level, I think it was, and I was with Callum. And it was so close to the ship. Like, you could fully see all the colours of its belly underneath and see it do its blow. And I was trying to identify what sort of whale it was based on the lectures that we've previously had, based on its dorsal fin and the way it flukes or the way it's blowing. But I think I was too excited that I was just focused on seeing the whale and I did not get to identify it whatsoever. But it was such an amazing thing to see, especially because it was so cold out there that I'm freezing. I'm like, ooh, that's a cool whale, but it was just so special to see.
On the journey towards Ross Island, we made a stop at Terra Nova Bay, passing by the modern-day Antarctic research stations of South Korea, Germany, Italy, and China. The team also took a dip into the freezing cold waters at Terra Nova Bay, a tradition called the Polar Plunge.
We're in line to do the polar plunge. We're one moment away. Noah, how are you feeling?
I'm pretty excited, eh? I'm really, really excited. I just want to get in the water right now.
Woo! Woohoo! Yes!
Ask Callum how he's feeling.
If there was a scale of excitement that went into the negatives, maybe a negative 10. So we'll see how we go.
Let's see how we were faring after our icy dip.
What did it feel like, Daniel?
Oh, no worse than Port Phillip Bay. Very comfortable. It's nice as you go in. I think I had a nice little dive there. I didn't see the judges' numbers, but it felt good.
Billy, what did it feel like?
It's like a quick shock of like electricity going through your body. But like, I'm grateful I'm the first New Zealand to Samoan to do a manu.
What did it feel like, Noah?
Oh my gosh, like, I swallowed half the water because my mouth was open, but it was so cool. I feel so good right now. I feel like I could run a marathon.
Tell me what it felt like, Noise.
It was actually really fun. It was super exhilarating. It's cold, but it's not as bad as I thought it would be.
The next day, it was on to Cape Evans. At Cape Evans, on a bed of scoria in the shadow of Mount Erebus, stands the largest of the Ross Sea huts. Constructed by Robert Falcon Scott's crew in just 9 days, the Cape Evans hut was the base of Scott's second and final Antarctic journey, the British Antarctic Terra Nova expedition, undertaken between 1910 and 1913. It's here that the British explorer and his team prepared for their ill-fated dash to the South Pole, little knowing then of the bitter disappointment and starvation that awaited them on the ice. Scott discovered all too late that he was to be racing Roald Amundsen's Norwegian party, who ultimately made it to the pole a full month before Scott. Scott, along with the rest of his polar party, Edward Wilson, Lawrence Oates, Edgar Evans and Henry Bowers, perished on their return journey. But during the summer of 1911 and 1912, while the men laid depots and dreamed of the glory that awaited them at the South Pole, there was a lot more to be discovered in Antarctica.
so many things that I didn't realise. And for example, in Scott's expedition, scientific exploration was a major part of it, and they went on this absolutely grueling journey, like the worst journey in the world, as it's, you know, touted, to get three emperor penguin eggs, because they had a theory that the embryos inside those eggs could tell them something about the evolution of species before penguins. Obviously, that theory was all very wrong.
Yeah.
Science proved that wrong, you know, not far later, but they made this huge journey to get these three eggs.
Yeah.
Which then didn't get touched.
No.
They just sat in the museum once they got back to Britain, didn't get used.
It's been really awesome learning about this history, and it actually makes it a lot more exciting to get to the continent and be able to walk the steps of Shackleton and those who came before us.
The men on the Terra Nova expedition endured many hardships in the harsh Antarctic environment, but inside the hut at Cape Evans, it was their shelter and their home for nearly 3 years. Left behind at Scott's hut are personal effects, journals and photos kept by the men in their bunks, revealing an intimate story of how they kept their spirits up while sheltering from the cold. Daniel explains more about one of these artifacts.
Something that I caught my eye just in the corner of one of the photographs of the Cape Evans hut, and it was above the bunk of Lawrence Oates or Titus Oates, and when we were in there, I looked out for it and saw it. It just kind of tucked in behind a little lamp and a bottle of cod liver oil, is a board covered with these fantastic portraits of different dogs. And it really struck me because, you know, around a lot of the other bunks, you know, there are portraits of kind of beautiful women or, you know, rugged-looking men rowing out into the, you know, fiery waves or whatever it is. But
this canine collage was in fact placed in the Cape Evans hut by a later expedition to the Antarctic, Shackleton's Ross Sea Party, while they sheltered in the hut between 1915 and 1917. Still, Lawrence Titus Oates was a core member of Scott's British Antarctic expedition and was one of the five men in Scott's fated South Pole party. He is remembered by most for his act of self-sacrifice. In March of 1912, faced by dwindling supplies on the return journey from the South Pole, Oates told Scott, "I'm just going outside and I may be some time," and left his tent to walk into a blizzard. Daniel reflects more on the story of Lawrence Oates.
He's a funny guy. You know, he's someone that wasn't or shouldn't have necessarily been as prominent as he is in the lore of those expeditions. But I think just he's got, of course, probably the most famous quote ever to come out of Antarctica. That, you know, just going out, maybe a while, maybe some time. It's just an iconic line, but also just referring to the ponies that were purchased for the expedition as what was it? A load of old crocs or whatever it was, also is just an iconic thing, and also sums up when everyone's talking about, you know, kind of the heroic age and all the wonderful things and fantastic choices made by all these great leaders. You know, he's got this one. He's the one guy that came out and said, like, this is dumb. Why are we, you know, this is a really, really bad choice. And he also, upon reaching the pole, he kind of had this, you know, where Scott said something like, what an awful place or whatever. He wrote in his diary that Amundsen must have had a great time of it, and he was a very clever fellow, and must have had a cruisy ride with his dogs, which I think says a lot. You know, he was probably thinking back to his lovely little doggies above his bunk when he was writing that, I'm sure.
The day after our adventures at Terra Nova Bay, we woke to see Mount Erebus ahead of us. And as we neared Ross Island, we began to see the scene of Scott's Terra Nova hut take shape.
We are at Cape Evans and we're right, the ship is anchored right outside the hut. It is remarkable. Louise, can you tell me what you see and what you're feeling? We've also just passed Shackleton's hut, Cape Royds. Tell me what's going through your head.
I mean, I'm just kind of in disbelief that we've made it here on such a clear and beautiful day where everything is just all there in its glory. We're under the shadow of Mount Erebus and I'm just looking at this hut and it is so close to me even though I'm standing on the ship, and it's suddenly, you know, it's incredibly real, and I can see the memorial cross from the Ross Sea Party. I can see the working quarters from Scott Base just to the right, and just being able to witness this whole landscape in all its glory is just so special. and I can't wait to go and step foot inside.
We're blessed with amazing conditions to be able to get in here. We can see the landing. We haven't been told that we're going, but we can see it, and we're really hoping.
We are hoping, and you can probably hear the anchor now in the background. You know, they're setting up the ship, getting us ready, hopefully. And, you know, in a way, it's bittersweet because we've learned from Al, you know, that this was Scott's hut for his last expedition. This was the one he didn't make it back to. And so I think it's going to be a really interesting experience, you know, stepping foot and seeing the amazing conservation work that Al and the AHT team have done, but also to really feel that weight of him and this the place, you know, where he last spent, you know, in a building, in a hut on this continent before he very unfortunately passed.
The weathered hut sits only a few metres up from the shoreline, surrounded by detritus. It is easy to imagine it has remained untouched since the rescue of Shackleton's Ross Sea Party in 1917, and even upon entering the hut, there is almost no indication that this site has undergone one of the world's most ambitious cold climate conservation programmes. In 2007, following years of assessment and planning, the Antarctic Heritage Trust initiated major building and artefact conservation works. 53 conservation professionals representing 12 different nationalities worked through all Antarctic seasons to remove, document, treat and return over 11,000 objects that tell the stories of the polar heroes and to make the building structurally sound and watertight. A lab for artefact conservation was set up at New Zealand's Scott Base, 22 kilometres away, and heritage carpenters worked on site to thaw away the ice and piece the hut back together. Landing on Ross Island for the first time, our boots crunched over the scoria, the ice having melted away. Underneath our feet, the ground felt like an archaeological dig, the tiniest remnants of the Terra Nova expedition left uncovered by the ice. Strikingly, a store of mutton carcasses, frozen and preserved by the ice, was exposed to the air. We all hiked up to the cross at Wind Vane Hill, a memorial to three members of Shackleton's Ross Sea Party who died there in 1916, 3 years after the departure of the survivors of the Terra Nova expedition. McIntosh, Hayward, Spencer Smith, the Reverend, the man who died here and who are commemorated by the cross up on the hill behind the hut. Daniel, what have you noticed going around outside the hut in the last wee while?
It's so incredible to be here, not just at the hut. Of course, the hut is an amazing place, and just to see it for the first time, I think all of us really were just completely silent when we were up there on deck just looking at it, because we've talked about this so much, and this is the hut that in lots of ways it was kind of the biggest one and often gets kind of quite a lot of attention. So to see it for the first time really was an amazing thing. But actually landing on the beach and looking around, it's so interesting. You know, we're here, and usually when you see it in photographs, it's just surrounded by snow and ice, and it's kind of just the hut in the landscape. And it's amazing because it's just this like tiny little bastion of, you know, of warmth and strength, and, you know, four solid walls, and you kind of see that as the image. But being here on the beach with all the kind of snow thawed out, the snow melted, and just seeing this kind of volcanic ash on the beach, or scoria, or just the little stones, and all the little artifacts that are in this beach tell so many different stories and really bring it to life. Just walking around, there's so many little smashed bottles, you know, little medicine bottles or alcohol bottles, or there's a tobacco tin, there's an ice pick, a bamboo kind of walking cane, and so many different things, and from different periods as well. So there are things that, there are kind of tent pegs relating to, I guess, later expeditions, a few screws around, and just so many objects that tell so many different stories on kind of different spots on the beach. It's such an interesting thing to see kind of the environment around the hut come alive, because it's really, when you read about these huts, you know, you think of them as being just out in the wilderness of Antarctica, but really it's kind of this whole area that would have been the home for, you know, the men that were living here at the time that they were living here. And you can see how they really inhabited the spaces around, and all the kind of different spots where, I don't know, they might have sat for a bit when it was a sunny day and had a drink and just kind of piffed the bottle out, or there's remains of seals that you would think they might have, you know, shot for food or whatever it is, and they've left just the tail fin, or just all the little bits and pieces strewn around the beach, and these huge anchors that are related to the Ross Sea Party, you know, that are there, kind of dug into the beach, dug into the sand. They're humongous, you know, and it's an amazing thing to see them, and just to think of the ship kind of breaking loose from those anchors and drifting away would have been one of the most devastating things to see. It's just an amazing place, and there's so many stories here, just in the soil, in the sand, in the place. It's great to just really see it come alive as you walk around.
After visiting Scott's Terranova hut at Cape Evans, Maya talked to roommates Callum and Kitiona about what it was like to step inside.
Yeah, that was crazy. Like, seeing all the artifacts, like the broken glasses on the ground as soon as you enter the beach. When you enter, you get that smell of blubber. It smelled weird, but I think they used it for like oil, which I just learned from Cal. On the chart table near Scott's bed, where there's like a big ass penguin. I thought Mike was lying about like how big it was. But like after seeing that, damn. Yeah, I'm just shocked.
There was one bit. I really love watching you in there. But there was one bit, there was the light switch. Could you talk to me about the light switch? Yeah.
Bro, the light switch so old, but it's like, it looks vintage. Like, I was like scooping through the area until I see like a light switch, and then I told you to come to confirm if it was a light switch. In Antarctica, that's like a light switch in Antarctica. I thought they would be using like campfires for their lights, but that's something new.
What were your impressions, Callum?
So I had the opportunity to walk ahead of the group and just have a minute in there to listen to the sound of the building, and actually I didn't really record for long because you just, as you walk in, you're cloaked in actually quite a heavy silence. I think the artifacts and I think the wood, the material of the place, sort of really absorb the sound in there. So you just walk into this sort of darkened room. Of course, there's no lights on, and you're only getting what's coming through the windows. So you sort of see these different parts of the room lit up by the sort of dim light coming in and lighting up all these artifacts. And I think that the two senses, I guess, that were really quite stimulated was smell and sight. The smell, of course, the sealed blubber, which I think when I first entered the main room, I actually found it quite pleasant. It was, I hadn't actually smelt, you know, seal blubber before, but it also sort of smelled familiar, I guess, like maybe like a steak fat or something like that. But then, of course, when we went around and had a look at the stables, and there was a pile of the seal blubber there, I think the smell of that really got to me. I actually felt quite nauseous after that. It was just a bit, it's a lot seeing, you know, essentially like a 2 meter slab of fat, you know.
It felt like alive almost, and that it was still present. This was a thing that was alive, and it smelt, and it was dripping, and it was shining in the light. It was insane.
That's right. I was surprised to see it dripping. It looked like it really just been put there recently. So I think the conservation team did a really good job at making it feel like, you know, the men have just gone out for a walk and you're going in for a little nosy.
I got stuck in the kitchen for a minute because it's right in the doorway after you walk in. There's all these food stores, and I was just struck by, there was these three tins of Coleman's mustard. It's a yellow tin, and I was struck because I use that at home. I use that exact mustard. My mum has always used it. I use that mustard powder. And the enamel and the things, it just reminded me so strongly of, I guess, just New Zealand, maybe that's our British culture coming in there, like that history, but I was surprised at how familiar some of the things smell for me. What else stood out to you guys? I feel like there's so many more. Was there any other things that stood out to you?
Inside the hut, something that was really cool to see were the materials used for blankets and for shoes and everything. Everything was made of animal, essentially. That was the really striking thing about if you look closely enough at anything. It's glass, metal, or animal. Or maybe wood. You know, the materials are, you know, kind of limited to a few categories, right? You know, you're not. Whereas with modern things, you know, you go into an alpine lodge these days, there are so many materials going on. I mean, even the clothes that I'm wearing, I'm wearing, what's it called? It's Pertex. I'm wearing what even is Pertex?
What is Pertex?
That's right. So, you know, I'm wearing my Pertex pants. And I'm looking at, you know, fur bedding, and I'm going, okay, things have changed a little bit since then in terms of polar exploration. So, you know, that's just a moment of that made me feel like I was really living in the future, and they had no idea what, you know, or who would be coming in after them.
There's a big ass anchor that's right outside the house. I don't know who put it there because it's heavy. I don't know how they got it there.
I feel like we're missing the big obvious one for me. The striking thing about the location of this hut is that you've got Mount Erebus right behind it. And it was just this, the most stunning mountain. And we're there on a clear day, which is very lucky and fortunate for us. And you just have these beautiful lenticular clouds kind of curving around it. And just parts where the snow has pulled away, and you can just see the sort of sea ice beneath that snow. It's just stunning. It's a very beautiful spot where they put this hut. In a way, I can actually quite understand why they put it there.
It is literally meters away from the sea, from the coast. It is very remarkably close to the water.
We saw it from the boat. Quite clearly, didn't we? Where we were anchored. Normally, that's not the case. Normally, we have to kind of, you know, spend a few minutes on the Zodiac. But that was like 10 seconds on the Zodiac to get to the beach.
And that was because obviously there was no sea ice really in the bay around it. And the reason we saw things like the mutton that you mentioned and the dog grave that I did and even the anchor was that there was no snow. It had all cleared away, which isn't, you know, a normal thing really. Look, people go there, I've heard you can't see everything, but because there was no snow around, it had all cleared, it was all scoria, it was like an archaeological site. There was stuff everywhere you stepped. I think I pointed out to you, Kitiona, there was a broken nail just under my foot.
Kitiona mentioned the sort of mutton carcasses, these bones and sort of preserved flesh, and just heaps. It's two heaps on the ground. It's very striking. And we were told earlier that was previous site of an ice cave where they would preserve this meat, right? Because it would be super cold in there. The snow and ice is not there anymore. So it's just these heaps on the ground. Makes you feel strange.
I felt like I was at home. I didn't feel like I was at Antarctica. If like the place was like covered with, I don't know, paint and stuff, it would feel like I'm at home. But like once you step out, you're in Antarctica, so that's pretty shocking. That's how I felt.
I honestly really agree with you. Yeah. I think it felt a lot like home. You could feel the sense of homeliness in it.
Yeah, actually, I totally agree. I try to imagine myself being back with the party, or, you know, just with any of those men back then. It really does feel like a refuge in there. It's quite nice. And I can imagine when it's all lit up and there are people, you know, about, they should be pretty nice for the most part. I'd rather stay aboard this cozy ship, but
The anchor spotted by Kitsiona at Cape Evans belongs to the ship of the Ross Sea Party, who used the hut for shelter from 1915 to 1917. The plan for this party was to lay depots for Shackleton's planned transantarctic expedition. However, they had no idea that Shackleton's ship, the Endurance, would be crushed in the Weddell Sea before they could start. Without the knowledge of Shackleton's plight, the men continued to lay depots for the first season. But during the winter, a blizzard blew the ice at Cape Evans out to sea, and with it, their ship, the Aurora, ripping it from the anchors holding it to the shore. 10 men were marooned on Ross Island with limited supplies. They improvised clothing and equipment, making use of the items left behind by Scott's expedition, and forged ahead to lay all of the depots that Shackleton would have needed. They were picked up, finally, 600 days later, and the Aurora's anchor still remains on the shore at Cape Evans. We also spoke to Alfastia about his experience working on the conservation of the hut, and now being able to share the place with other people, like us.
We've had the, though, like Scott's Terra Nova hut completely stripped out, you know, and it's been a workplace and a place of high stress for me and completing the project. But with having the artifacts conserved and put back into the hut, and the hut, you know, structurally sound and weathertight, I still get moved, and I still feel the spirit of place. I still feel the historic stories in the shadows of the hut.
As we walked around Cape Evans, all of us noticed the artifacts exposed on the ground. Al gave us some more understanding of the situation.
So within the building, as every artifact has got an artifact number, in the environs, maybe not. And we talk about the spirit of place within the building, but there's also that spirit of place in the environs as well, and that's just as important. At Cape Evans, there's been a lot of snow melt in the last 5 years, and a lot of artifacts actually are coming to the surface, and that's a challenge for the Trust for two reasons. As one, it's actually, you know, what, once an artifact comes to the surface, you know, what do? You just leave it sitting there? You know, what's its value? What's its significance? Do you bring it into the hut? And as you saw last night, you get people walking around and amongst the artifacts in the environment. And that's, you know, fine. Like last night, we can see where we're walking and people were getting guided. But when there's a dusting of snow and people can't see the artifacts, you know, it's easy to stand on them and to damage them. And people have different ideas. I was talking to a gentleman this morning, and he's thought that the site looked a bit of a like a rubbish tip and should be tidied up. And other people think, no, it's great. You know, it sort of like tells the story in itself. So the Trust is reviewing the conservation plan for Cape Evans at the moment, and I think a large part of that review will be around the artifacts and the environs.
Al said one of his proudest moments was from working on the Terra Nova hut.
I have many moments where I'm proud, but not only for me, but for the team. And a story I told yesterday was about lifting the floor, and it was major. Removing the ice and then putting the floor back down, and then putting the fragile lino, rolling it out. And then the head of Antarctic New Zealand turned up when we finished the project, and he came in and said, Al, I hear you're lifting the floor next season. And he couldn't see that any work had been done. And so I felt very proud that, you know, we basically stripped the hut out, lifted the floor. It was full of sort of equipment, heat exchangers and the like, and put the hut back together, and it was impossible to see that we had been there. So, no, as I always say, it's a really interesting job. If you can't see what work we've done, it's been successful. So that was a good example.
Day before yesterday, we landed in Gondwana Bay, among, you know, the rocks and stones of the German research station. You had a bit of a first there, Kitsiona.
Oh, yo, I got was a bit emotional, like, feeling. Like, I got to touch snow. That was just, it was unbelievable with Mike taking photos. I even got to take photos with my flag. Samoan flag. Yeah, I got to represent my hometown. Yeah.
We haven't actually had much snow and ice on the landings that we've done. It's been really dry. I don't know, is that what you expected?
No, for me I expected like something soft where you can like crunch it into a ball and you can throw it, but like it felt like hard ice.
Yeah, it has been. We've been very lucky with our weather. That's what the expedition leader has been saying. But you know, it's. I think that our good weather patch will end. But while we're in the midst of it, it's really making me think like, maybe it is warming up down here. Because when we're in Gondwana Bay, I had to actually take off like so many layers. It could have easily been a pretty regular Wellington day out there, you know, in terms of the temperature.
I had to get like 4 people to extract myself from my overpants, which are like basically overalls that are tight up against me because I was boiling.
After we visited the hut, we actually went on a little Zodiac tour around the bay nearby. There was a island that we visited, or you know, went on the outside of, because it was called Inaccessible Island. It was very inaccessible. It had all this push ice, so this ice that had been pushed by other ice into this kind of thick wall, and had all these kind of sort of ice stalactites dripping off it. It looked quite crazy, and then of course you've got this just sheer sort of scree cliffs going up it. It looked like a great place to put your fortress if you wanted no one to ever get in.
In the next episode, the team will cross the sea ice to visit the hut of Shackleton's Nimrod expedition at Cape Royds, and they'll start making preparations for the return of the Count of Monte Cristo, with fingers crossed that they'll make it to Hut Point.
This episode was written and produced by Maya Ingo, with additional writing by Daniel Bornstein, with technical production and music by Callum Turner, and narrated by Jake Bailey. Thanks to the donors, to the Trust Inspiring Explorers Fund, expedition partner Heritage Expeditions, and supporter Cheshire Architects.